we're back again. We're here to talk about the trial being held in Sanford, Florida. It's the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman. Greg, are you here? Eric, are you here?
I'm here. It's great to be back. A lot's happened this past week.
Oh, my goodness sake. Eric Dubois is an attorney, a practicing attorney in Orlando, Florida, and he is the attorney that is helping us define a lot of these expressions that a lot of people take for granted and they throw around. And basically, I hear now the television stations are using the expression voir dire, something that they don't even know what it means, and they say it so freely. Eric, why don't you tell the public what that means?
Voir dire in legal terms is a process of questioning and getting the truth out and determining, and as an attorney, we voir dire potential jury members to determine who's going to be an appropriate member to sit on the jury and determine someone's fate, someone's guilt or innocence. And what we've seen so far in the Zimmerman trial is a pool of 500 potential candidates be narrowed down through the voir dire process of questioning by both the state and the defense as to any general preconceived notion of guilt or innocence, pretrial publicity that potential jurors have seen, potential racial bias that they may have. And that narrows it down to what we've got now is a pool of 40, where we'll enter what is phase two, which is in a normal trial is all done at the same time, but in a trial of this magnitude, in a trial that normally gets this much pre-trial publicity, is done in phases, where it'll be more talking about the facts of the case and theories of the case. The defense, I would imagine, will talk about presumptions of innocence and the right to defend yourself in generalities, not giving specifics about the case or facts, but questioning the 40 potential jurors as to any preconceived notions that they may have, thoughts, dispositions about being pro-state, pro-defense, and then hopefully, God willing, by the close of business Friday or even Saturday, depending on what the judge does, we'll have a jury of 6 jurors and 4 alternates, a jury of 10 out of this 40. So hopefully Monday we can start opening statements and get the real show on the road, which is the trial.
Well, Eric, many people have asked me, well, what they're asking me now, I see in one of the chat rooms and in the Google chat, they're asking me to slow down. They're trying to understand what we're saying, and a lot of them are not native English speakers, but they are fascinated by this trial. A question that's come up again and again is why we don't automatically have 12 jurors, which is what most of the states are accustomed to. Why the amount of jurors and then the alternates? Why 10? Why 6 and 4? Right. Why is that?
Well, in Florida, if it's not a capital offense where the death penalty is not at issue and the possible sentence isn't death by lethal injection or by the electric chair, the jury is only a panel of 6 people who are of your community, similarly situated, a jury of your peers, which could be anything from men, women, as long as you're over 18, a jury. The judge, within her discretion, has the ability to set a number of alternates. And the great thing about the American justice system is the jurors won't know whether or not they're a primary juror or an alternate juror up until after closing arguments and the judge says jurors 15, 25, and whatever, you know, the numbers, because the names will be confidential. You know, these jurors, you are not to go back into the jury room and deliberate, but you're to remain because, God forbid, during the deliberation process, when the jury is out making their decision based on the facts, if someone becomes ill or something comes of the, one of those jurors, the judge can then say, alternate number one, you're going into the jury. You're now a primary member of the jury. And in a case like this, you see a number of, the judge has picked a number of four for alternates, and that's based on the length, the expected length of the trial, which anyone is saying between 2 and 4 weeks. So there are a number of issues that can come up with the regular jurors that would prevent someone from being able to finish and going through to a verdict. But in the American justice system, and specifically in Florida, if it's not a capital offense where someone is not facing punishment by death, it's not a jury of 12, it's a jury of 6.
Well, today in the newsroom at the courthouse, we interviewed, I made an appointment to interview Benjamin Crump at noon, but we had to move it to 2:30 this afternoon, and we were able to have that interview, and it was very successful. It was fascinating, some of the things he explained to us, and he was explaining that if the roles were reversed, and it had been a black man of the same age as George Zimmerman that had shot a teenager the same age as Trayvon Martin, that the amount of protest would have been deafening, and they certainly would not have allowed him to go home with his gun. What do you say about that?
I mean, it's very speculative, but I would imagine that that probably would be the case. Unfortunately, there, regardless of what we want to believe, profiling does go on, and there's a presumption that, you know, if an African American male shoots an African American, shoots a white male, that the presumption is that it was, you know, unjustified and not proper. Unfortunately, that's still society. You know, given that it's 2013, we haven't really moved past that in this country. We see it happening every day. But unfortunately, I think Mr. Crump is right, that probably would have happened, and the riots would have been a lot, the protests would have been a lot bigger and a lot stronger, and there probably would have been some more, you know, reaction towards the initial arrest or initial questioning.
And I noticed that very quietly, and it was really fast and smooth, and I saw no protest, was that Mr. O'Mara asked the judge to ban the prosecution from using certain expressions. For instance, he can't use the word profiled.
Right.
Why is
Correct.
That? I mean, why was that not argued when the word profiled was actually used in the affidavit that they wrote on April 20th to arrest him in the first place?
Well, first of all, Mark O'Mara is a great attorney, and a quality attorney, and very well respected. And part of what he's trying to do is keep out anything that could inflame the jury or create something that's so prejudicial against his client. The burden's on the state to prove that Mr. Zimmerman, you know, did wrong. And if you bring race into this, that it was a white male versus a black male issue, that's going to set a whole nother tone for this case, when the fact of the matter is Mr. Zimmerman didn't know Trayvon Martin at the time was African American. He called the police because he saw some suspicions. He then later stated it was an African American male, but at the initial time there wasn't that racial bias, and that's what Mark, I would speculate, Mark is trying to prevent is that racial profiling, that racial bias, that when you say this is just a white male against a black kid,
Just a moment. Are you moving around because your phone is going in and out?
No, I'm sorry. I'm stationary, so I don't know what. But no, can you hear me now better?
Yes, much better.
Okay. Part of the issue in this case is you're going to have the undertones of race. And what both the defense and the state needs to do is keep as much of that race out to focus on the issues, to focus on whether or not George Zimmerman, as we can imagine the defense is going to be, was in fear for his safety, was in fear for his life, was facing great bodily injury, grave harm. And as soon as you add race into that and you say he was profiling or you say he was targeting a specific person based on his race or his gender, that creates a whole different burden for the defense and something that they shouldn't have to, quite frankly, deal with and have to overcome. That's not part of the law in Florida. The law in Florida is, if George Zimmerman acted in self-defense, was he reasonable in that justification? It has nothing to do with what color or what gender the other person was. And that's what I speculate Mark O'Meara is trying to do, is keep that information out, which the judge agreed that, profiling in those terms, too inflammatory, who has the right, has a right to a fair trial. I hope that clears that up.
There's the word vigilante. He can't use that. He can't use the word, the expression self-appointed neighborhood watch captain, wannabe cop. He can't say get out of the car after the police, got out of the car after the police told him not to. And another thing I wanted to mention to the public that we just, that we've learned as lay people is that when a police officer gives you an instruction, you can get arrested if you don't follow his instructions. But when a dispatcher, a 911 dispatcher, gives you an instruction, you actually are not under an obligation to follow that instruction, because 911 dispatchers are actually not the police. And many people didn't know that. They thought that if an individual was given an instruction by a 911 operator, that they had to follow it, thinking that they're from the police department. And that's not the case, is it?
No. When you call 911, they're citizens, they're lay people, they're not deputized by the sheriff, they're not deputized by the state of Florida, at least in Florida. The presumption is that you're going to follow their commands and their instructions. But there's no legal obligation or legal basis to do that. And that
Correct.
Is where that's where I think a large part of this case is going to fall, is to what was George Zimmerman's obligation when he was asked, and basically that's all he was, is he was asked by the dispatcher, we don't need you to do that, more of a suggestion than a command. Was he under any obligation, and after that, did he become the initiator and the instigator of this altercation that eventually led to the death of Trayvon Martin? And that's where this case is going to hinge, in my opinion, as to what the jury believes.
And the jury, as you said, will be 6 jurors and 4 alternates. And no, it's not going to be 12 as we are accustomed to in most states. And we are going to have a guest join us. Give us a second. Let me get him the number. Here we go. There we go. Well, one thing that we discussed today was very interesting was that I had spoken to George Zimmerman's brother, Robert, and I had asked him if he was going to stop tweeting incendiary, inflammatory statements. And he kind of said yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. He didn't give me an assurance. And but I guess he must respect what I say, because the very next day he did go on Fox and he said that he would not be using Twitter for the duration of the trial, which I'm very glad about, because it seems to me ridiculous to have the attorney not want to use race and then have the brother use race. It seems to me odd, in fact, that Mr. O'Mara, who seems to always have a handle on his cases, has what I consider a loose cannon in Robert Zimmerman Jr. Eric?
No, I agree with that. I would not be surprised if after, maybe it was after your conversation, after Robert Zimmerman's press conference that he held, that Mark O'Mara kind of told him, hey, look, you've got to, as a family, you've all got to tone this down. Let myself, let Don West, let the rest of the defense team do our jobs and put your confidence in us. You guys have hired us. You've asked us to do this on behalf of your brother, of your son, of your husband. Let us do our jobs. And I think part of what we saw this past week since the last time we spoke was, Judge Nelson, entering the order that the jury, once it's seated, would be sequestered. And I think that also, I would speculate, is part of a response to some of this pretrial publicity and the constant. We live in a totally different age than we did during the O.J. Simpson trial. With social media, we've got reporters in the room who are sending out tweets and tweeting, minute by minute, witness by witness, blow by blow of this case. And social media and high-profile cases has changed the way the courts operate, whether we want to acknowledge that.
By the way, Syndicated News also tweets through Syndicated News on Twitter and Syndicated right. Talk, and we tweet constantly about this case.
So there's a lot of information. There's a lot of information that's getting out, whether or not, here in Italy, the trial, once it starts, will be on all the local news channels, all the local TV channels, from 9 to 5 or however long testimony is going on. But for most of our listeners for this show or around the world, they can follow the case on the internet. They can follow the case on Facebook, on Twitter, and social media. And part of that is we need to focus on the facts. There's a lot of information that we in the community are going to hear that's not admissible as evidence in a court of law in the United States and specifically in Florida. And part of what I would imagine Mark O'Mara and Don West and the defense team was talking to the Zimmerman family about was, let's focus on the facts, let's focus on the issues, let's try this case. And Mark O'Mara is renowned for that, is we try our cases in the courtroom. We don't try our cases on the street corner. We don't try our cases on the front page of the newspaper. We'll try our case in the courtroom, and the jury will speak, and the jury will render a fair and just verdict. And that's it. And that's the system that in America we have and that we all put our faith in. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's wrong. But at the end of the day, the extracurricular activity and the extracurricular press conferences don't do anyone any justice and don't do anyone any good. And I think what we've also seen from day one with Mark O'Mara and the defense team is a tremendous amount of respect for the loss of life of Trayvon Martin and his family. There hasn't been, you know, the onslaught of disparaging comments. There, you know, that's all, you know, whatever justification, whatever rationale George Zimmerman had for doing what he did, will all come out in trial. We haven't, there hasn't been this bad-mouthing and this blackmailing or, you know, devastation of Trayvon Martin's name or reputation prior to trial.
And I noticed also that there is so much that can't be said. For instance, propensity of behavior.
Correct.
And
part of that is...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. No, part of, and the propensity for behavior, and part of that is that George Zimmerman had no personal connections, personal references, any reason to believe or know the individual that he was confronting that night. So any potential of Trayvon Martin's past or behavioral issues or disciplinary issues that he may have been in had no basis for George Zimmerman's decision-making that night. And what's on trial is not Trayvon Martin's past, but what was going through George Zimmerman's head that night in February when he got in, you know, there was this altercation and a young man was killed. So why Trayvon Martin was in Sanford, what was on his cell phone, the state is going to argue has no relevance. The defense is going to argue that it's because of these things that caused Trayvon Martin to act irrational and attack George Zimmerman. And that's what, you know, that's the other facet of what will be presented to the jury.
And one thing that really surprised me was that in the midst of trying to establish themselves as a family, the Zimmermans, that are not racist, it's by coincidence that the NAACP invited me to Orlando on Thursday night, and I went there with Michelle Bostic, my assistant, and when we got there, by coincidence, the president of the Seminole County chapter, Mr. Turner, happened to be there. So we were able to interview him and ask him about this case. And I wasn't just thinking propensity of behavior of the teenager's behavior. I'm also talking about the adult, about past of his regular behavior, which is a bit spicy from what I see.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's, you know, there's, it's a very...
I found it unusual, and I don't want to sweep it under the rug, but I found it very unusual that after having had, whether by mistake or deliberate, doesn't matter, but to have had physical arguments and altercations with police officers, to then say he wants to be a police officer and include those behaviors, those incidences, those things that happened in his application. I find that unusual that someone who's so anti-police also wants to be a police officer. I find that unusual. And that he would put it in writing.
Yeah, and that's part of where, you know, for Mark O'Meara and the defense team, that's one of those slippery slopes that they run the risk of, you know, whether or not they put George Zimmerman on the stand. Because, you know, the state can't enter evidence and can't provide evidence about his character. And that's all that is his character evidence as to the type of person and his propensities that he has. But if he takes the stand, that stuff is fair game.
Absolutely.
And
I wanted to say, one thing that I found extremely important was the brouhaha surrounding whether or not the teenager had access to or it was interested in or was smoking weed or not. And by the way, I also have to say, I'm aware, as you know, you can't unring the bell. I mean, it was all over the papers, all over the radio and television, that George was taking two psychotropic drugs at the time. What are they going to do? What is O'Mara going to do with that? What is Mr. West going to do with that information? Because the public is aware of it.
It's going to be one of those questions. I mean, to be honest with you, I have no clue how they're gonna dance around that issue. You know, I've heard the reports of THC and drugs being found in Trayvon Martin's body, which I would imagine they're gonna put on evidence. You know, defense is gonna put on evidence that would. You know, someone being on THC isn't going to have rational thoughts and isn't going to be able to control their mannerisms and their behaviors and how they react to things. I haven't heard anything about George Zimmerman being on any drugs or anything like of that nature.
It was in the New York Times.
Okay. I haven't heard of that. So, but that's going to also cause some issues for the, the state will present that to show that, he may have been acting and had not a clear perception of what his reactions were or what someone else's behaviors may have been. But I think also for the biggest hurdle that the state's going to have to overcome is how did George Zimmerman sustain those injuries to the back of his head and to his nose? Where
well,
did those come from?
I've had teenagers show me how easily any individual can sustain damage to the nose and to the back of the head. And more importantly, I'll tell you something that concerns me a little bit. I saw those photographs. I have them. I'm looking right at them. And I see that the blood streaks are dry. And they're pointing vertically, meaning that his head was in a vertical position for those blood drops, those streams of blood to go downward. If this had happened and he were laying down, the blood would have gone backwards because his head would have been horizontal with his body. And that concerns me a lot. Why isn't that blood going backwards towards the ground instead of downwards as he was photographed?
Well, part of what I would imagine the defense is going to say is these pictures were taken, we don't know how long after, the shooting, how long after George Zimmerman was standing upright, how big those wounds were. If they were taken 15 or 20 minutes after the shooting, after George Zimmerman had stood up, then blood would be dripping down the back of your head.
Well, we have one of our listeners here in the show. Join us.
Yes, my name is Patrick, entomologist.
Hi, Patrick. Welcome to Syndicated
News. How are you? Good, good. And my perspective is probably going to be more from just your average citizen. So I don't know the law and how things work legally. But as people who are just observers, now I'm here in Georgia. So Georgia has the Stand Your Ground law the same as Florida does. Now my first question is, because I'm really trying to get a handle on this law, the more that I hear about it, the research that I've done on it, my interpretation is that the Stand Your Ground law is based on, and correct me if I'm wrong, or at least give me the legalese of it, it sounds like it's based on a perceived threat. Not so much standing your ground, just the fact that you feel like you're threatened. Let me give you an example. I stay in an apartment complex, and there's a bus stop right out the front of my complex, and I live in the front. And let's say one day I'm running late for work, I know what time the bus comes, and I know it's about to turn the corner and come up and stop. And I start running, and there's somebody that's walking into the complex that sees me running towards the bus. Let's say they're a licensed gun carrier. And they perceive me as a threat, as somebody that's actually running towards them, and they get their gun out and shoot me under the stand your ground law. Now, I'm dead. Is that legal?
Eric, you've got to jump in there.
In a way, you're right. It's all based on perception. And that's why last week I said, and I maintain it, that there's only one person that knows really what happened, unfortunately, that's still alive, and that's George Zimmerman. But it's all based on perception and the reasonable fear of great bodily harm, and that's the standard in Florida. And in Florida, the great bodily harm is, you know, defined as blood. You're drawing blood. So if the defense can put on a case that shows that at that time when George Zimmerman pulled the trigger, he, an adult, was in reasonable fear for his safety or being subjected to great bodily harm, then the stand your ground law should apply. In your hypothetical, the question for someone would be, would it be rational, would it be reasonable for you to be in fear for your safety if someone was just coming towards you? Was there any threat of violence? Was there any action to show that they were going to do something towards you that would cause some harm?
Right.
I would say probably not, unless that person coming towards you had, you know, an 8-inch blade sticking out of their hand or a gun, and you were, you know, and they were yelling things at you. But again, there's only one person that would know that because you're unfortunately dead.
Well, exactly. I have a question. I didn't see in the autopsy. I read it very carefully, and I don't see not one tiny little scratch on either of Trevon's hands or knuckles or fingertips or anything. How could he have done so much damage to George Zimmerman's head without having sustained the least little scratch? How did that happen?
Right.
I'm just being the devil's advocate here. Excuse me.
Well, I haven't read the autopsy reports, and I haven't seen that. I'm waiting to see what comes out in the courtroom. My understanding was that there were some scratches on his knuckles, but you know, someone could also your hand doesn't necessarily get scratched if you make skin to skin contact. Your hand doesn't necessarily, or your knuckles don't necessarily get scratched if you grab someone by the shoulder blades of their shirt or jacket and are lifting their shoulders up and up and down, up and down. As long as your hands don't come in contact with a rough surface, your hands really aren't going to get scratched. And that's where I would, you know, if there are no scratches and he makes nothing on his hands, that would be my guess as to what the defense is going to argue.
Okay.
Well, I'm looking at his autopsy right now, and it says, there were no scratches or bruising on the body, none whatsoever, not on the fingers, not on the nails, nothing.
How could he?
Go ahead, please, Patrick, go ahead, jump in.
No, I was just going to ask, are the 911 tapes going to be admissible or not?
My guess is no.
And why is that?
Because it's not the science and the community doesn't as a whole accept the reliability of those 911 tapes and of the audio transmissions, the being able to determine whose voice that is. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no studies, there's no proven, you know, case out there that says you can you can take normal conversation like you and I are having right now and then exchange that into loud screams that are somewhat inaudible and determine
Let's take a moment and hear one now. Let's hear one now.
When do you need police, fire, or medical?
Medical.
Okay, what location are you at?
I think someone's been shot.
Where at?
Oh, my God.
Where? Okay, why do you think someone's been shot?
Because they're laying out in the backyard, and a gun just went off, and they said call 911. Now there's people coming with flashlights. Get inside, get inside. Get inside. Who are they with flashlights?
Okay, hold on one second. And it's in the back of that backyard?
It's in the backyard, yeah.
And there's someone laying in the backyard?
Yeah, and there's people around them now with
Okay, that's one. And we just want you to hear a variety only because this was happening at the same time. One moment. We're not going to make you suffer through the entire tape. Only the parts that we think are crucial.
911, do you need police, fire, or medical?
Police, I just heard a shot right behind my house.
Where at?
They're wrestling right in the back of my porch.
You just heard one shot go off?
It was either that or a rock at the window or something. I don't know. The guy's yelling help, and I'm not going outside.
Okay.
Sanford, Florida.
Is that one or two words? Because it's not accepting it. Okay, and you can hear somebody yelling for help?
I'm pretty sure the guy's dead out here. Holy shit.
Okay, we have several people calling in also. Anything else that you heard?
No. Guy yelling help. Oh, my God. No. There's a guy with a flashlight in the backyard now.
Again, I don't want to make you suffer through all of this, so I'm only letting you hear bits and pieces of it. By the way, we were congratulated, Syndicated News was, because we never edited any of the recordings. We played them exactly as released. Even though there are gaps where they are announcing an address or something of that nature, we didn't change them at all, and I'm glad we didn't because many people who changed these tapes wound up having to explain themselves later, and we release them as they are.
Well, what is your emergency for police, fire, or medical?
Police, please.
For what address or location?
I'm at... There's someone screaming outside.
Is that what you are at?
That's right, there is a gunshot. Hurry up.
Okay.
Yeah. Stanford, Florida, 327.
That's another family that called during the time when they had already heard the gunshot. Here's one a bit sooner than that.
911, any police, fire, medical?
Yes, I'm looking out my back townhome and someone's screaming help and I don't know, I heard like a bang.
Now, you said you live in...
The townhome? Yes, and I'm looking out my window, like my backyard, and someone's yelling and screaming help. And I heard, like a pop noise,
okay.
And they're both still out there right now. I don't know what's going on.
Well, I can tell you right now, you're not the only person that's calling. We already have one officer on scene and another on the way.
Oh, good.
However,
oh, my God, I see the person right now.
I
see him, like, walking. There's a man coming up. There's people coming out with flashlights. Oh, my God. I don't know what he did to this person.
Was it a male?
I can't see. There's a man walking out with a flashlight right now.
That was making the noise.
Pardon?
Was it a male or a free?
And that's as much as we're going to play of that. And I'll tell you, the reason I don't right now want to play where you can hear someone screaming, help me, and crying, and then you hear the gunshot, is because it's a very difficult tape to listen to. But it actually happened that way. Many people heard them fighting. And
right,
then
that's the one thing that I was going to admit to you was that when the incident first happened, being that I'm here in the southeast, neighboring state, we got the 911 tapes that we were hearing had everything on it. It had people calling, and it had some people had called in, I guess because they were right in front of their apartments, and
correct,
you could actually hear the struggle, and then you could hear Trayvon Martin, and then you could hear the actual gunshots that go off.
And that's
the difficulty
that they're having. They don't know if that was Trayvon or if it was George. Eric,
right, and
can you
the 911 tapes that you just played, those will be admissible because I'm imagining that those individuals who called will be called as witnesses.
They'll be subpoenaed.
And they'll be subpoenaed to testify as a witness, and they'll be asked, and those tapes will be be played. The issue is going to be whether or not an expert can come onto the stand and testify as to whether or not the screams that we hear in the back of some of the audio tapes, whether or not they can reasonably say, beyond a shadow of a doubt in their mind, who is making those screams.
Right. It's either this person or that person.
Right.
Another one. Give us a second. One moment.
Here. The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
The back entrance.
Are you following him?
Yeah.
Okay, we don't need you to do that.
The back entrance.
That was George. And one thing that was unusual about George is that he's got a long history of calling 911, but in the I don't know, 40 or 50 calls he made to 911, non-emergency dispatcher, at no time did he ever say, there's a white male walking back here in the yard. I found that unusual. Eric?
Yeah, I mean, this audio tape, that 911 call come in, because the dispatcher from 911, from 911 will be subpoenaed. It will be called to testify. But there's nothing, I didn't hear anything either that said there's an African-American male walking in the neighborhood. I think what he said was...
You're absolutely right. I got that information from looking at the list of calls that he made to the police station, and at no time does he report that there is a suspicious white male or female. The only calls he makes are that there are suspicious black males, and I'm wondering if he feels that because they were walking around there, they were suspicious, or does the young man become suspicious because he's black? Which is it? Patrick, what do you have to say?
Well, and I was going to say this. Now, being a black man, I'm living in Georgia. I'm from Oakland, California. Very rough town. A lot of stuff goes on there. This type of situation right here is not unusual. And I know growing up there in Oakland in the 70s, especially when crack hit, it was like a war zone. And one of the things that I wanted to stress and see how this would play out in a court of law is, if there is a perceived danger, and maybe it's just because of how I grew up, if we knew something was going on or something was going down, we didn't go in that direction. We went in the opposite direction. If we heard gunshots and we could hear where they were coming from, that's not the direction we walked in. It was like, oh, okay, here's what's going on. Let's get up out of here. That was our attitude. So I'm wondering how that plays into the whole legal thing. If there's a threat, why are you following someone anyway? And if you feel that that person is a threat, why are you going after them? Unless you're obviously a law enforcement official, that's your job.
He's not, and he's not a law enforcement official.
Exactly.
He was a volunteer.
Exactly.
But also, he's not supposed to be carrying a gun either. I can't get that out of my mind. Eric?
Right. Well,
He wasn't licensed to carry firearms?
He was licensed, but he was not supposed to be patrolling wearing a firearm. No.
Oh, okay.
And part of the neighborhood.
That's why the homeowners association had to settle with the parents.
Got it. Part of the national neighborhood watch program is that people on neighborhood watch will not be armed.
Gotcha.
I think what you just argued and what your points were, I think is what you're going to hear a lot of the state making in their closing argument, is that, you know, from the state's perspective, George Zimmerman was the aggressor. He sought out this trouble. He sought out this confrontation. A normal, rational person who had no ill motive would have walked away from an issue, would have called the police, and would have obeyed the suggestions of law enforcement. You know, stay away.
He did
exactly the opposite
of what he was told.
And part of what the state's going to argue is that his action negates the stand your ground and any self-defense argument, because he then became the aggressor.
And they have to ask, what about this Adderall and this temazepam? If he's taking that type of medication, how is it that he can be on that medication and be licensed to carry a weapon? I'm curious about that. What do you know about that, Eric?
I don't know of any relevance that has.
Relevance to me, because if I were behind a counter selling weapons and someone comes up to me and says, oh, I have some type of emotional or psychological problem for which I'm Adderall and temazepam, I don't know that I would be willing to sell a weapon to a person in that condition.
You're also doing that in a country where we can't get gun regulation to have mental health counseling and mental health evaluation of people who want firearms.
Right. I don't even think that's a requirement for a medical check background. I know they're trying to do it now. That's what Obama's trying to do now.
Right. So you can't, in some regards, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say, well, because you're on these meds, you shouldn't have this, but yet we don't want you to be able to do these evaluations.
Right, but that horse is already out the barn door. So that's
right.
Not
now,
even going to apply to this case.
Is that strictly the National Rifle Association
that's
so fervent? Because they give a lot of money to politicians, and politicians are terrified at saying anything against them.
Right, but I don't think that's going to play any part in this case. What's going to play a part in this case is going to be solely what happened that night, and what was going through George Zimmerman's mind, what his fears were, and whether or not those fears were reasonable, and whether or not he was justified in doing what he did. And there's only one person who unfortunately is going to be able to testify to that, and that's George Zimmerman. Because unfortunately, Trayvon Martin passed, and he's no longer with us.
And that's going to be, I think that's going to be the linchpin to the whole case, is the fact that there's no actual eyewitnesses.
Correct.
Everything that we heard was just people who heard stuff. They didn't actually see anything. Evidently, it was wherever this place is in Sanford, Florida, is not very well lit, and people weren't looking out their windows.
By the way, if you go to syndicatednews.net and you look for the live stream and documents, you will find that I have a link there to all of the photos released by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And they're all there, and you can see all there's the lighting there. It looked like 40-watt bulbs, actually. It was so dark. It really did. And it was so dark. When it's raining, you can't see at all. You can't see at all. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, I think another thing that you touched on that's extremely important is that the NRA has the whole thing with civilians being able to have guns. Man, they got that thing wired so tight that it's just like you can't even – it's like fitting a camel through the eye of a needle because, you know, like you were alluding to, the importance of a medical background check to find out if somebody's on prescription medication, whatever it is. I think the only check they do is for a criminal record. That's it.
But none of that is. I would be willing to bet none of that comes in as evidence. You know, and we've got to, you know, look, we just, you know, Orlando and Central Florida just got done with another huge high-profile case, the Casey Anthony case. There was a lot of evidence in that you and I and all of us can discuss outside of the courtroom, but never made it into the courtroom.
Right.
And in this case, there's going to be a lot of that as well.
Eric, and I'm so glad you brought that up because I think that when you start talking about the general public who's really not well-versed in, you know, what's admissible, what's not, what you can talk about, what's relevant, and what's not, that's what creates the firestorm in the general public because they don't really understand the legal wranglings of the whole legal system in terms of here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. They just look at, okay, what happened? Everybody's heard the tapes, and it's like, okay, for the average person, they're thinking in their minds, oh, this is a slam dunk. And it's never a slam dunk once it gets into a court of law. When you get lawyers going back and forth, you got jurors, it gets real clouded. And that's where people get incensed.
Correct. And part of you've got a lot of components at play in a trial, especially in a criminal trial. You've got the state attorney's office. You've got the defense attorneys. You've got a bunch of personalities. You've probably got three or four attorneys on each side. And if one attorney just sets off a juror, they may turn that juror off regardless of what evidence and testimony they present. That's why, you know, this voir dire, this questioning, the selection of the jury is probably 75% of the case because that's the most, you know, really in the eyes of an attorney, probably the most important part of a criminal case is selecting that jury, making sure you've got the people on there that you know are going to be of the right framework and the right mindset to make those decisions. But what we're going to have potentially Monday or Tuesday, the opening statements, those are, you know, that's where a lot of jurors will hold an attorney accountable for what they're going to present. And if you lied to me in opening statements, what else have you lied to me about?
Right.
And that's
now,
where...
Let Go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask, do both sides, the defense and the state, do they both have to agree on every juror in order for that person to be a part of the jury?
No. Each side,
they don't.
Each side gets a certain amount of strikes, and they can strike any juror that they want, so long as it's not just solely based on race or, you know, some bias. But basically what will happen is in jury selection, the judge will say, okay, jurors 1 through 10, because they'll all be renumbered once they start. And the judge will say, jurors 1 through 10, defense, do you have any objections? Yeah, judge, we strike juror 2. State? 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Do you have any objections? No. Okay, and then you can also have what are called back strikes. So once you get, if you don't object to any of those first, you can only go back and strike someone again. And then once you use up your strike, you're done.
Okay. Okay.
Once you
and
use
let
up
me,
your challenges, you're done. And that's
and let me ask you and the host this question. Because I know this is going to play a role. I don't know how much of a role it's going to play, but these type of cases always gets thrown out, either by somebody involved with the trial or by somebody that has a public voice. How important of a role, and the host has already alluded to this, how important of a role is the racial component going to play? Not in the sense that Zimmerman is racist. Not even in that, and I'm asking this question, not even in that sense, but in the sense of America's racial element when it comes to the judicial process. Can either side, mainly, is the state going to be able to use that to their advantage based on past case history?
They shouldn't be able to, and the judge will do a very good job of making sure that there's certain parameters set, which I think is why there are certain restrictions put on what the both attorneys can use, you know, the terminology, the wording, the word profiling, like we discussed earlier, and making it, sticking to the facts as opposed to making this a bigger picture, a bigger issue about race.
Right.
And that's, you know, the judge in a situation like this is really a referee and needs to keep the playing field even. And my guess is there will be a number of motions, but in the legal community, lawyers, what lawyers call motion in limine, which means a motion to restrict talking or anything being brought up during the trial. And I would suspect that the defense team will file some motions in limine to prevent and restrict any racial epithets, racial tones, racial profiling, verbiage from being admissible and used during the course of the trial. And I would be very surprised if the judge didn't keep it out, since there really wasn't any racial, you know, motivation here. This was an unfortunate incident that just so happened to involve, you know, an African American, you know, child. But there wasn't this isn't a hate crime in terms of what a hate crime typically is defined as.
Okay.
But I could be completely wrong.
And to take it a step further. Now, what about our talking heads? And I'll be honest with you. The two people I'm about to mention are two people that, me personally, I'm not even very fond of, because anytime something happens...
Spit it out!
Okay. What's going to happen when we got to listen to Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson? Because, you know, like you guys were talking earlier before I got on, and you made this point very clear, Eric, and I think it was a very good point. With the social media that we have now that we didn't have during the O.J. trial, I think these guys are going to be like piranhas in the water.
At, I don't know if it was Eckerd's or Walgreens or CVS, I forget. Doesn't matter. The point is that the machine didn't work, and they told him, well, don't worry about it. We're having the technician come in and fix them, fix the machine, and you can come, we'll call you when your pictures are ready. And they did call him, and when he came to pick up his pictures, the FBI was waiting for him because he happened to be wearing his, I'm sorry to have to say it, but it's not a swear word. It's what happens. He was wearing his KKK robes, and so were his other buddies. And this was in 2009. This wasn't 40 and 60 years ago. This was 2009. And I remember seeing that on, or the article was published by Orlando Sentinel and by Florida Today, which are the two big papers in our area. And within a matter of weeks, the article was still up, but the pictures were gone. And that's where we live. I'm not talking about 1919. I'm talking about 2009.
Just a few years ago.
We're only in 2013. And that made me worry. When I saw that, because I had, you know, I had come from New York, and I wasn't accustomed to people with, you know, with the hoods, with the little eyes cut out and the long robe. I thought that was something from yesteryear. And here it was happening right now, right here, right now, in present-day United States. And I realized, you know, I am below the Mason-Dixon line. This is Florida. This is not downtown Manhattan.
That's right.
So I can't make believe it doesn't exist here. It just happened in 2009. Eric, jump in here.
You know, this is the reason why the judge is going to sequester the jury, and why, you know, the jurors, once they're impaneled and once they're selected, are going to have very limited access to mainstream media, very limited access to what they read and watch on TV, very limited access to their, you know, ability to get on the internet. All their conversations and business with family members are going to be monitored. So it's that type of, you know, pundit talk and things that in this country we value, our freedom of speech and the ability to have these kinds of debates, don't interfere with the defendant's right to a fair trial.
Okay, let's talk about his right, George Zimmerman's right to a fair trial. Why then? Why didn't O'Mara know that George Zimmerman's father was going to release such a racist book? That it's so inflammatory. Talk about adding fuel to the fire. That's what I said to Robert Zimmerman Jr. And then his father comes out with that book.
Right.
Doesn't O'Mara have a control? I would take that whole family, shake them and say, everybody, be still and let me defend this kid. But the way they're all behaved, that book is outrageous.
Well, as an attorney, you can say that so you're blue in the face. But
yes. At
the same time, you can't. Mark O'Mara, you know, as good of a lawyer as he is, he can't be, you know, George Zimmerman, you know, lead defense attorney and the babysitter for the rest of the family all at the same time.
I got that.
At some point, he's got to be able to tell the family, look, you all need to do X, Y, and Z. You know what? And if they don't do that, shame on you. But I told you, and I can't be everything to everyone all at the same time.
And that his book is selling very well on Amazon.
Well, unfortunately, it's going to. But his Mark O'Mara's number one priority right now is getting an acquittal for his client.
And isn't that this behavior between the brother and the father contradicting what O'Mara's trying to do? Aren't they behaving as obstacles? I keep wondering
it's contradictory. It's I'm sure if Mark O'Meara had his brothers and his preference, it would not be what they were doing. But what's he going to do? He's not going to walk away from George Zimmerman. He's not going to walk away from this trial. He spent the past 18 months preparing for what's about to come down the road in the next, you know, 2 to 4 weeks. And if George Zimmerman's family wants to act that way, then they're going to act that way. But Mark O'Meara's priority is his zealous advocacy for his client. And his client's George Zimmerman. His client's not George Zimmerman's brother. His client's not George Zimmerman's parents. His client's not George Zimmerman's wife. His client's George Zimmerman. And he will move mountains and heavens and earth to make sure that George Zimmerman gets a fair trial to the best of his ability. And that's why you see the sequestration of the jury, their push for the limitations on the words and the way things can be portrayed during opening statements, closing statements. My guess is some of the upcoming motions in limine and the battle that he's raging right now to make sure that he gets the best jury he can for his client. You know, as an attorney, you can hope that you've got everything in control, you know, and that you've got control of everything. But at the end of the day, you realize you can't, and you can only focus on and dwell on the things that are within your power. And unfortunately, if someone's family members want to act like buffoons, you can only do so much.
Patrick, what say you?
I wanted to know, and I agree with Eric, it's like you gotta pick your poison. And his client is Zimmerman, and if the rest of his family, because if he starts focusing on dad and brother, that takes away from the case. And this is going to be one of these bench water or watermark, watershed type cases, just like the O.J. Simpson trial. So, you know, this is going to springboard somebody into extreme prominence, whether it's on the defense side, whether it's on the prosecution side. But my question, what I wanted to know from both of you, because I know that they were bringing in 19 more jurors yesterday, and I haven't been keeping up with this on a daily basis. And I just wanted to thank you guys, because now in the conversations that ensue on a daily basis, as this starts picking up steam, I can come with a more cogent argument, or not even an argument, just get people to understand, look, this is how the system works. You can't. Certain things are admissible, certain things are not, because people don't really understand that. But how far are we along in the actual jury selection process? Has that been done, or will that be completed by the end of the week?
Eric, why don't you answer that?
Sure. The goal from, I think the goal of the state and the goal of defense attorneys and the goal of the court is to have it done so they can start opening statements on Monday.
Okay.
They've broken jury selection down to, you know, a couple of phases. One was the phase that, you know, ended today, which was the narrowing down of the 500 people that were subpoenaed for jury duty down to a pool of 40, which then they'll all be convened together in the courtroom, and they'll all be asked the same questions, and it'll be more of a conversation amongst the jury members and amongst the attorneys as to, you know, different types of theories about, you know, how someone feels about self-defense, how someone feels
right
about the presumption of innocence. And that phase, my understanding is that phase will start tomorrow at 9 in the morning. And from that phase, they will pick, out of that 40, they'll pick the 6 jurors and the 4 alternates. So they'll pick 10 people.
So there's only going to be 6 jurors?
Yes, because it's not
Eric, would you explain that? Because that question comes up a lot. Explain about how that works in the state of Florida.
Isn't it supposed to be 12?
It's not.
No, listen, Patrick. He's going to explain it to you.
George Zimmerman's charged with second-degree murder. So it's not a capital offense in the state of Florida, which means his life is not at risk. He can't be sentenced to death. So in the state of Florida, because of that, you only need a jury of six for a trial. But because of the complexity of the case, the length of the case, the pretrial publicity, the judge has decided that she wants four alternates to make sure that, God forbid, if she only had two alternates and three people fell ill or had to get off the jury, it wouldn't be a mistrial and have to start all over again.
Right. Okay. Okay.
So, yeah, in Florida, because it's not a capital offense and not a capital case, you only need six jurors.
Wow.
But they won't know, of the ten, the six won't know who they are until the very end. So everyone has to stay focused.
Are all the 40 sequestered at this point?
No.
Since they've narrowed it down from, you said, what, 200 or something, 300 to 40?
500 to 40. They will not be. My understanding is they will not be sequestered until the ten are chosen.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
This is great information, man. This is great information because it brings a lot of clarity to the process, and what it does is it kind of diffuses that emotional element that we all know is going to crop up. Because as those two aforementioned people, okay, I already know they got, as soon as the fire starts burning, they got the gasoline cans ready. And as a black person, that's the one thing that I hate to see is that, you know, as black people, we get real emotional about stuff instead of understanding how it's supposed to work. And even if we don't feel that it's right, and even if we don't feel that, oh, well, it shouldn't be that way. Well, guess what? That's the way it is. That's why you have a legal team, and that's why they get paid the bucks to figure out how to get through that maze so that whoever your client is, through your ingenuity, your intelligence, your gift for gab, whatever it takes, can get you through it. So this is very good information for me because that way when these discussions come up, I'll be able to throw that stuff out there. Hey, in the state of Florida, this is not a capital punishment crime because, you know, just like...
a lot of people don't realize this.
Right. And you know that's going to come up over and over again. How come there's not 12 jurors? Oh, this is fixed. Oh, my God. And then, you know, if you don't understand... You got to understand law. It's different in every state. So I really appreciate this. This has been very educational for me, very much so.
And, Patrick, that's why I wanted to have a what I call a level-headed program, and I didn't invite, how would I say, a rabble-rouser. I invited an attorney, Eric Dubois, from Orlando. If you're coming to Orlando on business and you need an attorney, if you're coming to Orlando because you're relocating and you need a home, Eric Dubois is available. Eric, would you slowly give your phone number for those that are moving to Orlando, to the Florida area, and need an attorney? They can find you quickly. Give us your number,
sure.
Please.
Sure. The phone number is 407-219-9577. That's a direct phone number, and we're available 7 days a week by appointment, free consultations.
Eric, I'm going to tell you in the immortal words of Don Corleone, hopefully I'll never need a favor in the event that I do. I expect you to be there for me.
If you do, I'll be there. No one likes attorneys, so you need us.
Exactly. So
right.
Hopefully I won't ever be giving you a call, because if I am, that means something has gone awry.
Right. Well, I appreciate
that. Not necessarily.
That.
You might want to, invest in a business or buy a house. It could be something totally positive.
Okay. Well, that's true, too. That's true.
We do good things also.
Absolutely.
Okay.
On Blog Talk Radio, we are syndicated news, and we are always calm and relaxed, and we discuss things in a very logical manner. There's no screaming. There's no swearing. And those of you that didn't get on because you went, you came onto the show with the very colorful words, we don't have that kind of speech on the show. We avoid that. And that's why you didn't get on very likely. And
I think
Patrick,
I can't
thank you enough.
I'm just glad I had the opportunity. But I wanted to ask you, as this case unfolds, are you going to do more shows on this? Because I wouldn't advise
We're going to be here every Tuesday, and every day, if you go to syndicatednews.net, you'll notice that every day I do a 3 or 4 minute wrap-up of the day's events. And in fact, I'll put them on this, I will put them here in this area so that people can see it here. Because it's that serious and that important to know what's going on a daily basis.
Right.
But
and I'm bookmarking your website right now.
Yes, you're welcome to come join us on Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And Patrick, I can't thank you enough. I'm getting thumbs up from India, from China, from Belarus, Russia, from Costa Rica, Venezuela, and Mexico, because English is their second language, so when we speak it with this pace that I'm using now, they're able to understand us. And I'm very grateful that you spoke so calmly because everybody understood you.
Oh, well, that's great, and I appreciate that, too. But, you know, I've been on this earth for 52 years. I was fortunate enough to be born in 1960. To live through the civil rights movement, the equal rights movement. Yeah, I was born in 1960, and I was very aware at a very young age. So, you know, I was aware of all of those things because that was when America was going through its, what I call its Renaissance period. And then all of a sudden, once we hit 1970, everything changed and we went in a whole other direction, you know, and not getting off into the whole that thing. But my whole point is that I just try to approach things in an even keel, and I've always been, I was blessed, and I feel very fortunate that I grew up with all cultures. Okay, I can remember being in grade school in the 60s, and my best friend, in sixth grade, my best friend was Armenian, and I went to school with Asian kids, white kids, black kids. My grandmother was a migrant farm worker, so every summer I spent my whole summer working in the fields with Mexicans and Mexican kids. So I have all of that. I have all of that in me. So I see. I already know there's good and bad in every single culture, ethnicity out there. So I never get on this whole thing with, you know, oh, it's this and that. And that's why I had alluded to those comments about Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, because even though they've done some good things, they've also acted as court gestures where they've just fed the flames and just promoted things that I personally feel are wrong. Now, my mother would tell you something different. She loves Jesse Jackson. She loves Al Sharpton, but I know that's just the way it is. So I just try to bring a balance to the table. That's all.
Oh, we appreciate it so much. It was Eric, wouldn't you say he brought a totally different perspective?
Yeah, and I would encourage you to join us every Tuesday as things heat up and we can talk more about what's going on in the courtroom and the difference between what's going on in the courtroom and what the public perception is.
I will definitely do that, but I'm going to tell you guys now, it's an important thing, especially as human beings, is for us to have, even in the midst of tragedy, to have intelligent, insightful conversation to where we're pulling all of our resources together, understanding how the legal system works, and not allowing our passion and our emotion to put a shield over our eyes to where we can't even see how the mechanisms that are at work are working, you know, because I already know this whole thing's going to come out, man. It's, people are just going to be like, oh, okay, well, I don't care what the law is. Just kill the guy. He shot the kid in cold blood. That's
to,
it.
Right. They are going to talk that way. By the way, for those of you that are interested, we've included the dailies. I report right from the courtroom, from the court building. We are in the media room, and I would say it's a 3-minute, 3.5-minute report that I prepare every single day, starting from the first day of trial, and I will be there on a daily basis preparing these reports on a daily basis. I prepare them Monday through Friday. I did not prepare them on Saturday because it wasn't necessary. But if something unusual happens, I will prepare a report, and you'll see all about it on syndicatednews.net. And as you know, our, how would I say our...
9577, and we offer free consultations, and I'm happy to talk to anyone about any legal issue they may have.
And Patrick, where are you from? Where in, give us a town.
Oh, I'm in Norcross, Georgia, which is about 25 minutes outside of Atlanta, north of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a nice little bedroom community that's very quiet, just what I need in my advancing age. I have no complaints.
Yeah. Well, I hope you join us on Tuesday nights and bring your friends.
I will, and it's syndicatednews.net.
Yes, yeah, syndicatednews.net, and on Blog Talk Radio, we are blogtalkradio.com/syndicatednews.
Okay, that I got, and I'm bookmarking .net as we speak. Okay.
And we'll be here on Tuesday nights to discuss this trial, because this is we're talking about civil liberties. We can't ignore that.
Yes, most definitely.
Eric, what say you?
I agree, and I think, you know, unfortunately, at the end of this case, there's going to be one part of our country that's going to be unhappy.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, the only thing we all need to unite around our criminal justice system and the Constitution and the rights that are afforded to a defendant, and know that regardless of the outcome of this case, it's the right and just verdict, and that everything was tried, all the evidence was presented, and a jury of Mr. Zimmerman's peers rendered a fair and impartial verdict, and we have to live with whatever decision that is.
There it
and
is.
And I'll say, when we talk about civil liberties, that's a discussion for another night. I'm very concerned with NDAA and FISA.
I would love to talk about NDAA. Done a lot of research on that one.
Well, we'll be discussing it again, Patrick. We have to do a show about that.
I've done a lot of research on the National Defense Authorization Act. It is nothing nice.
It is a dangerous, dangerous law. It's been signed into law.
Yep, 98-0.
And I want to discuss that. Patrick, we have to discuss this because that's so important. Eric, you might want to join us.
There wasn't one dissenting vote.
About NDAA and FISA. Hey, they can come right to you.
Good. Eric Dubois, Dubois Law Group. Phone number is 407-219-9577. And we offer free consultations, and I'm happy to talk to anyone about your legal issues and get you on the right path.
And Patrick, our resident Norcross, evening. You made the show wonderful.
It was
you and
was
Eric together. Fantastic.
Okay. Well, it was definitely my pleasure. And Eric, if you ever need, you know, some help, somebody to do the grunt work, you know, I can do that.
I appreciate it. If you come to Orlando, give me a call, and we'll do dinner or something.
Okay, no problem.
And this is Ruthie saying good night and thank you, listeners, in Arecibo, Maracaibo, Venezuela, Mazatlan, Mexico, Punjab in India. There's a name here I can't pronounce. We are being listened to. How sweet is that? We have people in Africa listening to us. And the list is too long. I'm not going to read it. So we're going to say let's wrap it up. And it's a wrap. Good night, fellas.
Good night.
Talk to you next week.